Welcome to Town Square. I'm Neil Milner, sitting in for Beth Ann Kozovich. In just a few days, a new school year will begin for Hawaii's public school children. In some ways, it seems like a new day. There's a new school superintendent, new state plans with objectives to vastly improve, if not transform, Hawaii schools. Yet at the same time, this also sounds not so much like a new day. We've been down this path many times before. Today, we'll explore public education in Hawaii with Corey Rosen-Lee, the president of the Hawaii Teachers Union, the Hawaii State Teachers Association. We want to hear about your own views about public schools and your own experiences regarding public schools in Hawaii. Town Square starts after the news. Welcome to Town Square. I'm Neil Milner, sitting in for Beth Ann Kozlovich. The new school year is about to begin, so today's show is about Hawaii's schools. Our guest is Corey Rosen-Lee, the president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association. Corey, welcome to Town Square.
Thank you for having me.
Well, since it's a new day, at least a new semester starting, let me ask you this. What's a parent going to see at the beginning of the school year that's different from what it's been before?
Well, one good thing that's going to happen is you're going to have thousands of kids this year walk into classrooms that have finally been air-conditioned. Unfortunately, we're going to have still thousands of kids that won't be. We do have a new superintendent, and we're looking forward to seeing what's going to happen there. But unfortunately, there are still some major problems that are going to exist that happened last year that will continue this year. We're going to have tens of thousands of children walk into classrooms next week, and they are not going to have a qualified teacher. Right now, the process is still an overemphasis on testing and teaching to the test. And too often what we have is mandated curriculum, top-down curriculum of what teachers are supposed to teach. So unfortunately, those things have not changed.
Well, this is a good blueprint for many of the things we're going to talk about today. Let me just follow up with this thing about teachers and non-qualified teachers. What's the problem there? Why does this happen all the time? And why isn't something done about it?
Well, first, let's look at the problem. And one of the things that came out recently was a study that was done in 2015 called the DOE Equity Plan. And one of the things that was really shocking about it, we've always known that we've had a teacher shortage. But when you look at specific areas, and specifically, say, like the Leeward Coast, and there's other areas as well, that 30 to 40% of all the teachers are either in their first year of teaching, they're unqualified, or they're out of field. So you can take these students that are basically, proving grounds for the teachers, and this has been a perpetual problem, but it's getting worse. And so these kids are denied year after year a quality teacher. And now the question that you asked, what's causing this problem? We just got a very good contract. We just signed recently a four-year contract. But when that contract came up, we did it within the confines of what the current state budget is for education. But we know that teachers in Hawaii, when you factor in cost of living, are the worst paid. But when you just compare it to other school districts, similar school districts, they're $10,000 to $15,000 underpaid than our things. And we just cannot keep and recruit teachers. But beyond that, it's about also professionalism. They're not allowed to teach. They're being told right now what curriculum to use on what day. And they're told that you have to get these high scores on these tests. And if you combine all these things together, unprofessionalism with poor pay, we just can't keep them or recruit them.
We want to hear what you think and your own experiences, posing some questions to us and some comments. On Oahu, call us at 941-3689. If you're on the neighbor islands or, in fact, anywhere else listening to the live stream, call us toll-free at 877-941-3689. There was a recent study that I saw that shows what they've showed for a long time, that Hawaii, from the standpoint of economics, is about the worst place for a teacher in the United States, and that the amount of money that they have seems to have a lot to do with it, with the salary compared to the cost of living. It's that if you want to be a teacher, don't teach in Hawaii. What do you say to that? What do you say is if somebody comes to you and wants to teach here and seems to be a qualified teacher, what do you tell them?
There was a study that came out last year from the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism that shows that Hawaii in the entire nation spends the least percentage of its taxation, both state and local, on education. There has been consistent studies to show that Hawaii has this huge turnover rate, and what we do know is it's getting worse. We have less students going into the profession, and we have more teachers leaving the profession, which is creating the gap. And at the beginning of last year, there were 650 vacancies. Now, let me put that into perspective. So my daughter, she's going to be a ninth grader at Campbell High School. 2 years ago, she was in seventh grade at Alima, and she didn't have a science teacher. And I went up to the principal and I said, look, that she has a substitute teaching her science class. I said, can't you find a teacher? And he said, there's no one left on Oahu. There's not one science teacher left on Oahu to teach my daughter. And she actually had four long-term subs her last 2 years. And that, you cannot think that does not have an impact on our students. And again, what I said before, if you look at the Leeward Coast, it's like 30 to 40% of their teachers.
We have a question, Steve from Manoa, a question about teachers' pay. Steve, go ahead.
Hello there. I was doing a study because I actually work in education at the UH. I was doing a study of teacher pay, and I noticed that statistically the lowest paid teachers in America are in Oklahoma. But when you factor in cost of living, Hawaii teachers are actually below Oklahoma, making Hawaii teachers the poorest paid in America. But my question is this: why is the state of Hawaii so manini? Do they not value education? This seems to be a change from 40 years ago when everybody said that Hawaii was gung-ho on education. Well, it's not true now.
Yes, absolutely. And that does show that. Teachers in Hawaii just can't afford to live here. What happens oftentimes is we go to the mainland and we recruit people, and we go to areas where they have a surplus, and we say, come to Hawaii, and they come here, and they live 4 to 5 to a house, and eventually by the time they want to have a family, they cannot afford it, and they leave. And so the question is, why does this happen? And this is the fundamental question. Why in Hawaii do we allow this inequality to continue and perpetuate itself? And I think the big problem is this. You know, in Hawaii, we think that we have an equal school system, that all of our schools are equally funded, or as I say, they're equally underfunded. But when we do that, we take out a key factor. And that key factor is our private schools in Hawaii. In the Honolulu area, close to 38% of school-aged children go to private schools. And what that happens is you take away, you know, this involvement in the community and this investment that all children must go to the same public schools. On the mainland, in communities, most of the kids go to public schools. They don't go to these separate schools.
Let me ask a quick – I know there are a lot of calls on the line, and I want to make sure that you be patient and wait. We'll get to you. But a quick question about that. Look, a lot of DOE teachers send their kids to private schools. What do you tell them? Is that embarrassing?
No. Look, we have amazing teachers in our schools, and I've taught with them. But teachers know what is the essential elements of school. You don't want to have 40 kids in a classroom. You don't want to have kids in a 9-degree, 100-degree classroom. You don't want the kids being forced by a curriculum and taking a test. You want to make sure that the person teaching your child actually has a degree in teaching in the matter, and so they know it. And so these teachers work their hearts out every day to give a good education. But they look at the system, and they look at the system as failing their children. I mean, I think that what we need to say is I don't blame any parent for putting their child in private school in Hawaii, but I want them to also say that we need to fight not just for their own children, but for their neighbor's child to make sure that they have a quality education as well.
We have a call from Jane on the Big Island. Jane's a former special ed teacher. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. I taught for 2 years and left the field because of a number of reasons. Pay was one of them. I would respectfully disagree with the commenter observation that schools are equally underfunded, because charter schools are even more underfunded than the DOE schools. A big reason that I left teaching special ed in a charter school was the conflict between the charter school and the DOE not working together to provide special education services. And the utilization of special education teachers who should be providing services that a child needs to be doing other things that the school needs done because they don't have enough money to have enough staff to do everything. You know, I saw coworkers who were special education teachers who were putting in more than 12-hour days. I had a coworker who consistently was at her desk before 6 a.m., and she was still there when I left at 6 p.m.
Jane, thanks.
At least 4 days a week.
Let me just give Corey a chance to comment to that. I appreciate the experiences. Yours are the kinds of calls that we want. Corey, you want to say something about that?
Well, first of all, I have great empathy for our special education teachers in Hawaii. Basically, in Hawaii, we're breaking the law. We do not have enough special education teachers. So to give you this situation, what's occurring is there was this school in Honolulu district. They had two special education teachers. When one of the teachers had enough, it's too much on her, she left. They could not find a special education teacher. They put in a sub. Subs cannot do the IEPs for the special education
students. That's individual education plans all of the special ed kids have to have.
So the teacher not only had to teach her class, but teach the other class and do the IEP for all the students. And she eventually said, she came up to me and said, I'm ready to quit. And the reality is that those students, those special education students, if they don't have a qualified teacher, they're not getting the services they need. And so what this teacher mentions is that we're not providing those services. They get frustrated. They leave. And this has just been a perpetually long problem that, you know, needs to be solved.
You're listening to Town Square with Corey Rosenlee as our guest. On Oahu, call us at 941-3689. Anywhere else, 877-941-3689, toll free. And call us about your opinions, your experiences with the DOE, any of those kinds of things. Corey, when the union gets this kind of story from a teacher, it must be pretty frustrating because there doesn't seem to be much you can do about it.
It's painful. I mean, we look at what's happening in our schools, and we have to remember this is for our keiki. These are our kids. And at the heart of the matter is, do we as a state, do we as a country believe that every child should have a quality education? And should every child have a qualified teacher? And should they have the basic necessities of our classroom? And we know we're not providing that in Hawaii. And I think it's something that we all must demand of our politicians that, you know, and this is the thing, is that every person has to be willing to say to their politician, education matters. It's about my child, about my grandchild, what is it, my niece. And only then are we going to start seeing the action. I mean, we know about these problems.
But that's a pretty general answer for all of us. What's the union do?
So, you know, the union for the, you know, I've been in office for 2 years now. And when I first came in, the union put out something called the Schools Our Keiki Deserve. And we laid out a very specific vision of what it's going to take to improve our schools. And we've started to make progress on those things. In the last 2 years, we have fought very hard to increase funding for our public schools. You know, when you talk about special education services, we need more special education teachers, we need the qualified teachers, all of these things must occur. And so we've been asking for more funding. We've been going to the Board of Education and to working with the Department of Education to try to limit the amount of testing that's occurred so teachers can teach again, to try to get rid of this mandated curriculum. So we've been putting out a lot of pressure and organizing in order to do this. And last year there was 6,000 teachers that marched on the Capitol demanding that we fund education better in Hawaii.
But you didn't get that tax increase.
We did not. But you know what the thing is? We're going to keep on going back. At the end of the day, it's either you accept inequality or you don't. I think, though, that if we're going to be effective, it can't be just the teachers out there. You know, it's going to have to be those parents that are saying to the legislators, it's important. Look, when we had Furlough Fridays, it was the parents that came out and they sat in the governor's office, and that was able to get the change. When we had the air conditioning 2 years ago, it was the parents that started sign waving in front of the Board of Education going to legislators. And it's when parents get involved and it becomes more than just teachers, I think that's when it starts getting the attention of legislators, and that's when they start taking that action.
We have a call from Paul Makawau about the statewide school districts. Paul, go ahead.
Aloha. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was a teacher at King Ke Kaliki High School for 3 years, and then I did a little bit of substituting on the side, but I left because the administration was terrible. I was the union rep at the school, and she really came after me. I was an English teacher, and I got to take the praxis, and why an English teacher has to take a math praxis, I don't understand it, but I didn't pass it the first time around, and then she got me. But anyway, that's not the issue. The issue really is the state-run school system, which is the worst school system in the entire United States. Education is the only thing, the further away you get from the primary task, the more money you make, and the only profession, rather. And everybody, I believe, every administrator should be in the classroom at least one day a week. I think that you never should hire a superintendent who has never been a teacher, and I think that it's really important that we get out of the state-run school system. Maui, all the counties could run their own school system. Maui could have one of the best school systems in the United States if we were able to control our own school system.
Thanks, Paul.
So I can understand the frustration that the caller had. What we don't want to do in Hawaii is recreate the problem that they have on the mainland. And what they have is you have two school districts right next to each other. One of the examples I give is Philadelphia, and right next to them is Lower Merion. Philadelphia spends half as much as Lower Merion does on their students. Philadelphia is 85% African-American Hispanic. Lower Merion is 85% white. And so you have this great inequality. And I would never want to see the day where Maui, for example, has a surplus of teachers and Kauai doesn't. I think what you want to do is, like what we've seen in other countries, is that they have that equality across their country and they have equity. There's two great stories that came out yesterday. One was in the BBC and one was in the Atlantic. And they're talking about Japan and Canada. And both of them now are some of the top school systems in the world. And the one thing that they both pointed to that helped those schools be successful is equity. So we do have equity. We just underfund all of our public schools equally. And if we could ever get to the day where we actually fund our schools well, we would start solving this problem. But the one thing that I would agree with him is we've got to bring more control down to the school itself. When schools and teachers and principals feel empowered at their schools and they feel they can control what's going on, that develops this sense of community, and that's when you see great change occur.
You know, it's interesting that Lower Merion, and I happen to know a little bit about that district, that's a kind of very common situation in most American cities where suburbs that are upper middle class, and that clearly is one, and predominantly white, which all suburbs aren't, but a lot of them are, have much better schools, at least in terms of the general way we manage. And so we, at least on paper, don't have that kind of disparity where you can move into a separate school system for better, but you still have the problem here. And so it has to be more than just separate schools.
So on the mainland, a lot of schools are funded by property taxes. Hawaii actually has the lowest property tax rate in the nation. So people, instead of having to pay a property tax to go to the public school system, instead can use that money that they save on their property taxes to send their kids to private school. And that's where our inequity comes in. So we have to understand that our system is unique, and that instead of having school districts that have inequity, our inequity is built in with our private and public school system.
We have a call from Carol from Wahiawa, another special ed teacher. Carol, go ahead.
Hello, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, yes. I wanted to make a comment on what the gentleman had just said versus Philadelphia and Lower Merion. I'm from Philadelphia. I am a product of the public school system. I have my bachelor's, currently studying my graduate, but I said this to say, it has nothing to do with the geographical area. It has something to do with the state appropriating that money where it needs to go to affect those communities to educate the children in that area. I live in Hawaii now, but what I've seen thus far, even with my said children, like this young lady said, there's not enough manpower, so to speak, to efficiently do our jobs as Fed teachers outside of having to do everything else because they're understaffed. So I really think, and it's nothing against Hawaii or any other state, but personally from my experience here coming from the mainland and from Jersey, they really need to stop making excuses with the DOE especially because they're the biggest problem with us. They need to appropriate those funds so these children, and especially the special ed kids, can get the proper services when we do these individual education plan, the IEPs. So I just wanted to keep it under a minute. I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks a lot.
So I think that she's, you know, correct in that I think if we make sure that the resources get down as much as possible to the school level, then we can make sure that those are going directly for the children. One of the big things is, and this is the problem we have in Hawaii, is we cannot easily compare our per-pupil funding to somewhere else. There's no one around us that we can compare to. But if you do look at, say, districts, see, if you look at districts with similar cost of living as Hawaii, and you look at their per-pupil spending, and you look at how much we spend on private schools on their per-pupil funding, what you can see is we spend about $6,000 less per child on average than the private schools in our comparable public school districts. And if we were to have that kind of resources for our public schools, then you could start making sure that we invest in certain things, try to get more special education teachers, try to reduce those loads. But we're not going to solve any of those problems. I mean, and I know that as the president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association, it may sound like this is our only focus, but it's not. But we need hundreds, if not thousands, of teachers in Hawaii. And right now we're negative, we're in a deficit. But until we have enough sped teachers, we cannot reduce the load on those teachers so that those teachers can start having that. Otherwise, we'll just keep on putting subs into the classroom.
Well, let me ask you a question, and I'm sure we're going to get back to the money issue as well. We should. We've been talking about the pure economics of it, too little money, too little resources. What else is involved here? What else makes a school system better or a school worse?
Well, the research shows very clearly this. The number one factor in improving student achievement is the quality of the teacher. That's number one. Number two is you want a lower class size. And that just makes common sense that when you have that one-to-one attention, that improves factors. Number three, you want to have a rich and diverse curriculum, something that's going to challenge the students. And what we've seen so far with the whole teaching to the test is we've taken away that diverse curriculum. In fact, for a lot of our students, we've dumbed down the material so you can just pass the test, and that's the biggest requirement. Other things is providing those social services that they need. One thing that showed remarkable success on the mainland is community schools. And what community schools is, you have to recognize the basic needs of a child before they get to school. If a child has not eaten, they're not going to perform in school. And some of our schools now in Hawaii provide free breakfast and lunch for all their students. You see healthcare happening. In Waianae High School, they're now providing healthcare for some of their students so they can be in schools. Some children need eyeglasses, you know, those kind of things. So, and even the whole thing of air conditioning, you know, it may seem like a little factor, but we're starting school in August. And it's going to be extremely hot and humid. And those basic needs of a child have to be met. And then we have to provide all those other factors as well.
Bob, go ahead. Bob's a retired professor. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, you're all right about just about everything. What I was going to say is this. I taught at for 20 years. I was responsible as a professor. I had to be department chair for a while, and I was responsible for managing the budget.
I share your pain. I was too, Bob.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I think the administrators would say, well, I'm sorry, we don't have any money for this. We don't have money for that. And we would maybe be teaching DOE people. Could be. But we all saw that there was money. It was just about where it was allocated. And then we started looking at how much the administrators get paid compared with the teachers. And talk about an inequity. My gosh. So I'll leave you with this thought. You know, they say if a company fails, it's because of the management, not the workers. Well, you can just extrapolate that thought.
You know, I've seen for certain schools in Hawaii that when principals share power with their teachers, what you've seen is great things occur. And like I've said, I'm really hoping under the new superintendent, Superintendent Kishimoto, that she starts returning some of the power down to the school level. So I'll give you an example right now what they're doing. They have these curriculum guides, Stepping Stones, Wonders, where basically they're scripted curriculums that teachers are told what to do. And it's leading towards how many tests they have to do. And some of our students are taking up to 10 standardized tests a year. And some teachers feel like all they're doing is testing and doing this curriculum. So the flexibility has to come back down to the school. The funding has to start coming back down to the school. And I think that when you do this, you're not going to see that, you know, it's not just one person that's deciding the whole fate of the school, but it's a community.
The new plan, the ESA plan, the Every Student Succeeds thing that the state has accepted will reduce the number of tests, right? Isn't that part of what the plan says? You're not going to have as many tests to take? I understand this is not implemented. It's aspirational, as I call it.
No. Right now, we've been the HSTA and teachers have been going down to the Board of Education. Just in June, we went down there and we said, look, there's got to be a limit to the amount of tests we have. And we had a teacher come in, and this is like a first or second grade teacher, and our kids have to take 10 tests. And you got to ask yourself at some point, how extreme is it that we're asking, you know, these 7, 8-year-olds to take all these tests? And so we've been asking the Board of Education to put a limit.
Well, I want to get back to you about the more basic question about these tests, and that is, what exactly do they measure? Because there's a lot of evidence now that they really don't tell you very much about whether a school is good. But we'll get back to that in a little while. I want to take some more calls here because many people want to call. Lisa from Volcano. Go ahead, Lisa.
If you'd like to make a call.
Lisa? Oh, we lost Lisa. How about Joel from Kona? Joel?
Hi. Hi, I'm here. Hey, I'd just like to share an experience. My sister-in-law and my brother live in Washington State. She has multiple degrees, including a master's degree in special ed. A couple years ago, as they're nearing retirement, she came to Hawaii to try to see how she could retire here. At the end of that little trip, she discovered that even with all of her degree and a master's degree in special education and years of experience, her pay grade would be recognized as a entering teacher and wouldn't recognize her experience nor her her degrees. I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
So, again, and this comes down to a funny question, is that a lot of school districts on the mainland will recognize years of service. One of the things that occurs is an emergency hire in Hawaii, and we had like about 300 emergency hires last year, make $35,000 a year.
Just to be clear, an emergency hire in theory is supposed to be for less than 100 days, right?
That's No. That actually emergency
hire. Well, that changed for.
You can actually, emergency hire can be up to 3 years as long as they're working towards a teacher license.
But, it's different for them. Okay.
But if they don't have it after 3 years, they're just gone. But then they can become a sub and just be put into a classroom long term. They can be a sub, I think, up to 180 days, and then they become an emergency hire. And so, yeah, so we have these vacancies, and we have these teachers coming from the mainland. But when you have – so say, for example, there was Waianae Intermediate in 2015. 50% of all their teachers, 50% were in their first year of teaching. Okay? And that doesn't include emergency hires or everything else. So these this is really cheap for the system. If you have this constant churn of new teachers coming into the system and leaving the system – and what they do is, like, say they come from the Northeast, get their experience, and now they can go back. It makes it very cheap for the system to constantly have these new teachers. But the ones that, you know, are not benefiting are our students because, look, I love my new teachers. They come in with all this energy. I remember when I was a new teacher and all this energy. But it takes time to develop your craft as a teacher. And, like, you, the more time you get to teach, the more experience you get on your lesson plans, controlling student behavior, and that's when you start getting that experience and becoming a better teacher.
Call us at 941-3689 on the Neighbor Islands or anywhere else you're listening, 877-941-3689, toll free. Your experiences with the DOE, people might have some good experiences that they would like to share with us. So give us a call and we'll see. You know, I want to get back to the comment that you made about the test a little while ago, that it occurs to me, it seems to me that the movement now is away from the reliance on the test, at least in other places, and that at least on paper, the notion is that tests don't tell you as much about the quality of schools and they do other bad things. You're saying it's not going in that direction here?
Absolutely not. In fact, we've seen the opposite occur. You know, one of the things we've been trying to advocate for is something called authentic assessments. Authentic assessments say, for example, instead of taking a test where you're pressing a A, B, C, or D key on the keyboard, you're doing a science project. You're writing an essay. It requires more thought. Challenging. We've been trying to advocate to move away from the standardization to more an open approach. And that's what research shows works. And that allows us, both students and teachers, to work together on those things. What standardized testing shows is the socioeconomic status of a child. And when we punish schools and students for poverty, we perpetuate the problem. And I'll show you an example of why. In schools that do poorly, in the past experience has been, and we're hoping this change under the new plan, that there would be more emphasis on reading and math. And if you take, for example, a school out in the Leeward Coast where, you know, you have a large Native Hawaiian population, and you strip away the art and the music and the Hawaiian studies and the culture, and it's just this sitting in this desk doing this math and reading and trying to get ready for a test, I think that is more destructive to the child than to the school system because of the emphasis on testing.
Well, what about the use of assessments as a way to evaluate teachers?
Even worse, because what's occurring then is that if teachers are going to have their pay tied to test scores, and thank goodness 2 years ago we removed it from our system, what happens then is it incentivizes teachers to not work in high poverty areas. So as soon as they get experience, they're moving into areas with higher test scores or higher socioeconomic situations, which means that, again, these high poverty areas are going to have the newest teachers that are coming into the system and whether they're qualified or not. And so I think that instead of encouraging to challenge teachers to work in those areas and incentivizing teachers teaching in lower socioeconomic areas, it does the exact opposite.
You know, what's always struck me about these kinds of evaluations about who's a good teacher and who's not a good teacher is that they seldom do any good in helping to improve teachers. That it's one thing, even if you grant the test some kind of validity, that the test identifies good teachers and bad teachers. I got some questions about the one that was used here. If 98% of the teachers here are effective or highly effective, either we're doing extraordinarily well or the test doesn't tell very much about how people can help. But it seems to me the issue of has to do with how do you make a teacher better? And the test is just, even if it's a real indicator, doesn't do very much along those lines.
The best thing we should be doing, and we've been advocating for the new contract, is that the process should be something like this. Beginning of the school year, teacher goes to the administrator and says, look, I need to work on this thing. Maybe it's improving my kids' writing. Maybe it's classroom discipline. And the principal and the teacher work together as a coach to try to help improve that teacher. If you do it as an evaluative, punitive process, look, the principal comes in, and for 40 minutes, you put on a horse and pony show, and you do all these things so you get a high rating, and then they leave, and you didn't improve as a teacher. They're just filling out boxes to do things, and we're not actually improving the teaching profession. It's not getting rid of bad teachers. It's not helping teachers improve their practice, yet we're perpetuating the system. So, I mean, that's something that we've been advocating, and we feel like we're moving somewhat in that progress, but it's something we still need to move towards.
Let me suggest how hard that is. I've looked at successful charter schools, not here so much, but on the mainland. And the ones that have really been successful, one of the things they do is spend an enormous amount of time talking to one another about curriculum and about teaching. That's the upside. It's also the downside because it makes a teacher's day even harder and even longer. So as someone who's concerned about teachers' welfare in that way, how do you handle that problem?
I think as a teacher, one of the most frustrating things that we hear is we only work 8 to 3. That's the time we're directly in front of students. But we need one of the things that teachers often say we need is time to talk to each other, to plan, to learn from each other. And we don't oftentimes have enough of that ability to have those conversations and improve practice, even with administrators. You know, if they're coming in and having to fill out all these checkboxes, it's not really starting this conversation. And I think that if we allow that flexibility and stop this mandated, pressure, got to get this test going like this, and we let people go back to the roots of teaching, what's going to occur is you're going to have more of these conversations, more of this flexibility, and more of the creativity that's needed.
Jerome from Hilo, go ahead.
I have three quick ones. Okay, well, the first thing they need to do is stop importing all of these administrators in from the mainland. Stupid prices, pay for their housing and all of that, and just hire from within the teachers. And also, they should have the teachers live in the areas that they teach in, so they actually know the people, and that way they can get a better understanding of what they're doing. And also, for union-wise, union, step up, man. Okay. Mahalo.
How would you like them to step up?
Yeah, that's what I want to know, too.
Well, you tell me.
I was a union steward also, and I know how hard it is for union and management to get together. The unions now, they're kind of, some reason, since Reagan started firing the air traffic controls back in 84, when I was a federal employee, and the union just kind of just, for some reason, this is just management union, you know what I mean, not the, But, yeah, the unions step up, you know, just tell them, okay, we need to do this. We need this for our teachers in order for us to help.
So,
well, how would you step up? I mean, you're part of the new order here. I mean, the way you got to office is essentially to say that the old ways of doing things in the union weren't working very well.
And our teachers have stepped up. And what we do is you create an opportunity for them to get involved. I mean, that was one of the largest rallies that the state has ever had when 6,000 teachers marched from Blaisdell to the Capitol to, you know, ask for more funding. You know, we had nearly 4,000 of our teachers sign cards and testimony, 1,700 emails. They've been going down and testifying. We've had a huge presence at the Board of Education, at the legislature trying to testify. And at this point, the union has stepped up. And this is what I'm saying is, it's got to be more than the union. If it's only teachers advocating for these changes, we're too easy to dismiss as it's self-interested. But when it has to be a coalition, and I'm so proud of the how many community groups came out last year and supported more funding for our public schools. And so the last caller is, it's got to take you, it's got to take, you know, your neighbors. Everyone's got to get involved. You know, in order to create the big change that's going to need for the systemic problem of education in Hawaii, the union's going to be there. We're going to fight. And I am so proud of my teachers for standing up last year and fighting. But we're going to need everyone to get involved, and I encourage you to do so.
We have a call from Carol in Waiakeola. But before we take it, I just want to comment how much or how little what Corey just said has to do with inside the bargaining room at the bargaining table. These are outside political events that you're talking about. Carol, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in on what I see. I live in Waikoloa on the Big Island. I'm from California. And I would like Hawaii to look at models on this particular subject. And this particular subject is tax-based from medical and legal marijuana. Talk to California, but mostly talk to Colorado and ask Colorado educators how much money they were able to get in the tax base from that to the education system. Hawaii can't get out of its own way. Medical marijuana has been legal here for many years, and they still are. When I watch PBS Roundtable on television, they're still stuck 25 years ago in their approach.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so, you know, a couple years ago when we looked at trying to see how we can fund Hawaii's public schools, we looked at everything, lottery, medical marijuana, you know, all sorts of kind of surcharge taxes. And the reality is this. There's only really three main taxes that generate enough income that can do it. When Colorado did do the legalized marijuana, it brought in about $40 million, and they have like 2.5 times our population in Colorado.
Is it earmarked for education?
Yes, it is. But $40 million would not do it. We're looking, we would need about $1 billion more just to bring us up to average when it comes to per pupil spending. But we are looking at trying to find a way to bring up about half of that, $500 million. You know, last year, 2 years ago, we tried the general excise tax, and that was didn't get enough support. So that leaves income and property tax. And income tax, we're already one of the highest in the nation. But property tax is the interesting thing in Hawaii. We have the lowest property tax rate in the nation. And because we're the only state that has not used property taxes to fund our schools. And people think, well, if we raise property taxes, that would make it harder to live in Hawaii. But it's actually the opposite. Because our property tax rate is so low, you look at in Kaka'ako right now, you have a lot of mainland buyers, foreign buyers that are treating Hawaii like a monopoly game. Buying properties, not even living there, but driving up the cost for everyone. At the same time, we don't have a revenue base for Hawaii. And so last year, we put up a constitutional amendment. And this got through 8 committees, got to conference. Hardly anyone voted against this, and this died. But the thing was basically we wanted to do 2 things to raise funding for Hawaii's public schools. One is we wanted to tax second homes, non-owner-occupied homes, over $1 million, and we wanted to raise the TAT. And we thought we were just asking the right to let the people in Hawaii vote to whether they wanted to fund our schools. And very few legislators were against it, and it still died.
Well, very few legislators said they were against it.
Said they were against it. Yes. Okay? And it died privately, and then instead of having to stand up and say, look, I want to vote against public education, they didn't want to do that. It was, you know, done behind the rooms. And at the end of the day, we didn't even give the people the right to vote. And that's something that we need to change.
Lisa from Waimea, go ahead.
Hi. I have over 30 years' experience of living here and working with the administration, including Mrs. Matayoshi, district leaders, principals, vice principals. And I disagree that these are admirable and worthy people. I find an overall climate of smug complacency at the standard. And I'm amazed at the people who cannot pass the basic test of the things that they're supposed to be able to teach. One additional extreme comment is we drug test waiters. We drug test construction workers, but the teachers union has adamantly protested drug testing teachers. These are people who work with our children, and I believe that this is a minimum standard that they should support among their colleagues. Thank you for allowing me to share my viewpoint.
Sure, Lisa. Thanks for calling.
I get this one once in a while. First of all, if there is suspicion of a teacher using drugs, they can be required and on that suspicion. But to summarily say to all teachers without any evidence goes against our constitutional rights. We're assumed to be guilty and have to prove that we're innocent. And again, I think it takes away the framework. Look, our teachers are not big drug users here. It's like, there's not this big problem that we have. We have very honorable people working in the profession. And it takes us away from focusing on the main problems. And we've been stuck on this drug testing as if this is somehow going to improve our school system. And so I disagree that we got to stop this conversation that somehow if we drug test teachers, all of a sudden our student achievement's going to improve. And it's just a distraction.
Does it still come up in collective bargaining?
It doesn't come up in collective bargaining, but once in a while, people are still upset about the whole thing that happened, you know, years back on the whole drug testing. And, you know, I really would hope we just move on from that conversation. It doesn't improve education, and it basically is just it paints teaching and teachers in such a poor light, which we just don't have this problem.
Debbie from Volcano. Go ahead, Debbie.
Well, if you want to keep your teachers, you're going to have to give them housing they can afford. And Oahu, if it's the $700,000 is the median price, there's no way someone's going to be able to buy a house on a teacher's salary, and let alone find someplace they can rent. Kona's the same way. Maui's the same way. I just don't know how people can do it. It's just mind-boggling that they can need the rent's way more than half of their salary. So how that has to be addressed. We used to have teachers' cottages when I first came here 43 years ago, and now those are gone. So that would at least help some of the keeping some of the people here. Until we address this, we're going to have a revolving door, I'm afraid.
And she's right. I know many teachers that cannot afford to live in the communities they teach because they just simply can't afford housing in those areas. And that's, you know, give Lahaina, for example. They just can't afford to live there. And that's true, that we need to be able to somehow think of a way to solve that problem. But in the essence, when it comes down to teacher salaries or housing, it all comes back down to money. And the question is, then where does the money come from? So, you know, Hawaii has not invested that money to do that. And then once we have that money, then we got to start figuring out whether it's salaries or housing or more teachers. Those are the questions that we need to start answering.
You know, she said, how can they do it? It kind of came up as a rhetorical question. But how do teachers do it? I mean, you have hundreds of teachers who put up with these kinds of difficulties. You yourself, you taught for many years in the system. What keeps you going? What keeps you in the classroom? What keeps you staying in the profession?
We love kids. I felt it was an honor every day that I could walk into a classroom and teach kids something that they've never learned before. I mean, their passion is infectious. And the sad part is I was teaching with a teacher at Campbell this year, and him and his wife were both teachers, loved teaching, good teachers, and he was moving to Vegas because he just couldn't afford it anymore. And about half of our teachers actually work second jobs. And that's the way they survive. And they have to ask the question at some point. If I'm working 12 hours a day, then, you know, take my vice president, Justin Huey. He is a teacher in Maui. He was a waiter also as well, and he would come home late at night, and, you know, he'd be exhausted the next day. And how much attention can we give to our students? And I think a lot of the teachers finally ask the question, do I want to continue having to work two jobs just so I can afford to be a teacher? And that's just not a, you know, situation that they should put themselves into. And for a few years, I taught on the mainland. And when I saw teachers, two teachers could make a good living and own a nice house and, you know, have those kind of situations. And it's sad that that just doesn't occur here.
Elaine from Ainahaina. Go ahead, Elaine.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Yes, I wanted to, start to agree with the person who discussed apathy. And I think apathy is across the board. I was going to share an experience where I had initially interviewed the principal at Ainahaina Elementary, where I was going to send my two boys. And I felt actually that kind of apathy there when she couldn't describe what the kindergarten teacher would be teaching that year at all, or the first grade teacher or the second grade teacher, and handed me a book of standards to look at as far as what my children would learn, which was indecipherable. And as it turns out, I decided to go with the private school route, and I found out subsequent to that this woman was my one of my best friend's cousins, and she had sent her kids to Punahou. And the kids, and just the way she had talked about, well, all these kids aren't, you know, private school quality that come through these schools. And so it's not all, you know, it's not someplace they should be. And what the part of the apathy, I think, is, and I've lived here 41 years, I do have a master's in teaching, and I have never taught because of the lack of enthusiasm for education and the heavy duty administration. I'd like to address the high overhead for administration in the DOE. That the last time I looked at stats, it was more expensive per child.
Okay, Elaine, I think we get the gist of your question. We want to move on to get as many calls as possible. So thanks, and we'll get to Corey on this. Corey?
It was interesting. I mean, when I was listening to that last caller, and she was getting frustrated and her sent her kid to private school. I think that's a common story. Interesting enough, I thought to myself, what would happen if she didn't send her kid to private school? How much more she would want to change that system? And I think that when going through the experiences that I've gone through as a parent, I think it makes me more aware and makes me a better advocate. You know, the administrative costs, I think, is something that when we give more local control at the school level, I think naturally comes down because, look, one of the things that happened under the evaluation system is they needed to hire more administrators to do more of the teacher evaluations. And the cost benefit of that is the opportunity cost for that was that that you could, you know, increase class size because you can afford less teachers. So I think that we want to have a process where we do not have as much administration. And what we've seen sometimes even at our charter schools is when they're given that funding, then a lot more of that funding goes directly to the classroom instead of administrative costs.
So what do you think about the quality of the principals overall? Is it vary? How important is it?
You know, I think we have some great principals, and then we have some people that shouldn't be principals at all. Again, it's the qualities they bring into the classroom. The experience I've had is the ones that tend to be the most top-down, the ones that are not collaborative get the most resistance and actually get the worst results. And those principals that tend to – interesting, sometimes the principals, the ones that are most willing to buck the system, including the DOE, are able to have great experiences. And I think that's why we need to make that more systemic, that we allow schools to run and try to experiment, and we need to share their successes so that we can learn from them. And too oftentimes what we do is we don't give that kind of freedom.
Pete from Wanalua, go ahead. Wanalua, go ahead.
Hey, aloha. I'm one of the many recovering casualty teachers of the education system, having resigned after many years of teaching. I don't want to repeat anything that's been said. I'm in general agreement with most of the conversation. I wanted to just raise some other ongoing issues, if I may. My fallout with the DOE, and if I may say, my students would have described me as a rock star teacher, someone that hates, the kids told me they hate history in school, so they would come to my class. So that's the feedback I would get. So why would I leave? Well, I had my own child, and when I saw what we were doing to our kids, and that is reducing them to numbers, you know, you always talk about testing and so forth. You know, I couldn't no longer do that. If I couldn't put my own child in through that, I wouldn't want to do that to other kids. And so what I want to move to is another issue of what we consider education or the function of education. What I'm focusing now is the culture of education we have here and what people believe it to be about. And the trend now, of course, the buzzword is college and career readiness, which I will state there is nothing wrong with being college and career ready. However, I would say that that fervor that we've killed ourselves with No Child Left Behind, A Race to the Top, we're continuing that culture and the buzzwords through the buzzwords of college and career readiness. And because the testing now, they're focusing on ACT and so forth. So we really, there's been reform, but it's really stuck. And I want to say that one of the most hopeful times I've had in my years here with around the DOE was giving some credit to EGAE's task force. And when I heard some of the proposals, when they were looking at the most innovative education around the world, going to Finland, getting experts, I was like in tears thinking like, wow, this is the classrooms that we want, that we can make them the best for Hawaii.
Not- okay, I have to, we have to cut you off there to give Corey a chance to answer. I just want to point out about the governor's task force. This is all prospective, that as it should be at this stage. This is not anything that's been implemented yet, but it's been accepted, and there's a fair amount of consensus, at least at the higher political level. Corey, go ahead.
First of all, my first observation was how many of these former teachers were calling in today, and that shows you that, you know, we have teachers within Hawaii that want to teach, and how do we retain them? He's absolutely correct that there's, I think, like the emphasis has been, you know, to the test, to college, and one of the things we have not looked at that has been ignored because of the amount of testing is career and technical education. And, you know, one of the things we really need to do is realize that our students come with us with many different skills and different passions, and we need to grow those students that and find their own passions and help them grow with that one. To the governors as a task force, you know, there was a lot of good conversations that occurred from that, but my fear is that becomes something that's going to be put on the shelf because, again, I have not seen enough action come from that ESSA task force that's going to be trying to move our state in that direction.
One of the things that I've read about these kinds of federal implementation plans generally is that they're all kind of high-level aspirations and no one really knows yet how to do it. For example, our reaching being one of the best school systems in the country in 20 years, which would be require a gargantuan effort that pretty much would have to overcome all kinds of social and economic things. Corey, in the last minute, what would you like to say? What would you like to add?
At the end of the day, I went in to be the president of HSTA because I deeply care about children. I deeply care about equality, and our teachers do too. For too long in Hawaii, we have basically segregated our population in the way we educate them. At some point, we have to say this is enough, this has to change, and that's going to take all of us to do it.
Thank you very much, Corey, and thank you to the, especially to the many callers that we didn't get to. I'm glad that you found the topic interesting. I apologize, but in this case, apologies suggest a good thing. This is Neil Milner saying thanks for listening to Town Square, and thanks again to Corey Rosenlee for being here today. Have a good day.